Father Colin Blatchford, welcome to Power and Witness Podcast, and you are the Associate Director of Courage and Encourage.
Uh-huh.
And let's give a quick thumbnail of what those two groups are.
Sure. Courage International was founded in 1980. Cardinal Terence Cook in New York, he was Archbishop, Cardinal Archbishop of New York, was looking at the West Village and the Stonewall area, where they had the Stonewall Uprising for gay rights. And he said, you know, there's got to be something for those who struggle with this, who mm-hmm. want to live their faith. And so he went to Father Groeschel and he said, you know, I think there's, you know, we can come up with this and there could be something like this. And he goes, and you can run it. And Father Groeschel said, no. But he said, I know a guy. Uh-huh. And that was Father John Harvey. He was an Oblate of St. Francis de Sales from Philadelphia. And he'd been doing this particular kind of ministry, working with individuals who experience same-sex attraction, but who are trying to live the church's teaching of chastity. And for probably 15, 20 years before that, mostly religious and priests, but also laity. And so he went up there for the first time. He met with five or six guys. They came up with the goals over the course of that first year. To live chaste lives, to avail themselves of the sacraments and frequent reception of the Eucharist and confession, to form a support group and hold each other accountable, to form friendships, to learn how to do that better, and then to live lives that serve as a good example of others. And it developed from there. Mm-hmm. And they met in the Elizabeth Ann Seton Shrine in Manhattan, and they're still meeting there today, which is pretty neat that it's still going on.
Is that like in lower Manhattan?
Mm-hmm.
Like,
okay. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a cool little church if you ever get a chance. But about 7 years into that, so 1987, there were a number of parents that had been reaching out, and Father Harvey had been working with them individually. Okay. And he realized that maybe there was a place for a support group for parents, loved ones, aunts, uncles, friends who had a loved one in the lifestyle, and they're trying to maintain that relationship while practicing their faith and not compromising those values,
right.
But also leading the individual, you know, to the fullness of the truth, but without just beating them over the head, right?
Yeah.
And that's where Courage was, or Encourage, excuse me, was, that's when it was founded. And they also have five goals, and they kind of mirror the goals for Courage. And it's, you know, to learn more about the struggles that the individual has, to avail themselves of the sacraments, to help their family members and friends understand the reality that that individuals who struggle with this are going through, but also, you know, what the church teaches, to offer that support to each other, and then, you know, to make sure that the person that they're in relationship with that's in this lifestyle knows that they're loved and cared for.
And like in forming friendships, I imagine sometimes there might be you're in kind of the lion's den to some degree, right? If you're attracted to that, y'all have like boundaries or ground rules or something that you just have to take personal responsibility that you don't fall in love with this person? Or?
Sure. I mean, that's a reality. There's always prudence to it, mm-hmm. right? But I mean, we're created to be in a relationship. That's, you know, let us create man mm-hmm. in our own image and likeness. So we're not going to get out of that. You can't live a solo life. There's a particular expression of love that cannot be expressed between, you know, same-sex individuals. You know? But, you know, there's all sorts of places for intellectual intimacy, emotional intimacy, psychological mm-hmm. intimacy, social intimacy, spiritual mm-hmm. intimacy, and even physical intimacy to the extent that I can give you a hug, a handshake, mm-hmm. Be in the same room, sit on the same couch, mm-hmm. enjoy things together. I mean, we all need that.
And
helping individuals kind of work through that. I'm thinking in a particular instance, you know, the individual is expressing concern about this person nearby who lives down the road from them that they're very much attracted to, right? But they would never do anything with them.
Right.
They've made that clear. They've known them for a long time. It's just not even something that would even be on the table. Okay, well, then don't worry about the thoughts that come up. Laugh at them, invite Jesus in, mm-hmm. and move on.
Yeah.
Right? Like, because there's a, so we learn through forming habits, and over time we'll do something without even thinking about it, right? Like we go outside with clothes on because it's a habit we've formed. We don't forget mm-hmm. to do it. Well, if we've objectified people or seen them as a potential sexual partner, that habit has to slowly be informed. And this isn't about changing an orientation. The church doesn't care about that. She cares if you're virtuous. Mm-hmm. And so if the concern is, well, I keep having these thoughts, we don't really have control over our thoughts, Francis of Sales tells us in the Introduction to the Devout mm-hmm. Life in Book 4. But he says we do have the ability to respond to it, right? And so if that thought comes and we find ourselves entertaining it, and then immediately when we become aware, we say, well, no, I don't want to do that. There's nothing wrong with that. That's just us responding to it. And so helping the individual to understand that in the context of a relationship with another, a same-sex person and opposite sex too. Oftentimes there's some affective immaturity in there and maybe struggle with forming intimate relationships with same-sex peers without this sexual component. Mm-hmm. And so like working on that and focusing on that so that we can have a fulfilled and happy life where we know we have a lot of friends, right? We're not alone. We may have some solitude because we live on our own, but there's a difference between solitude and loneliness. Solitude is, I recognize that at this point, at this moment, nobody's around me, but I also know that I'm loved and cared for and I'll see them, later tonight or tomorrow.
And I find too, sometimes just preaching on the issue that of same-sex attraction that I understand, you can hear people's struggle that, well, you're telling me I can't get married. I can't have this intimacy. And I think courage has as one of its goals to focus on, you can have deep, rich friendships that are fulfilling. But what do you tell a person that's same-sex attracted and say, well, you're telling me I can't get married. I got to be alone, quote-unquote, the rest of my life.
Well, and it depends on the person and how I'd approach it, right? So that's going to be unique to the individual, but the basic sort of premises would be, is it a reality that you won't be married? We don't know, right? Like, we have members that are married and have children, so they clearly love their spouses. They also don't have it within them, having talked to them, to sexually objectify their spouses who are of the opposite sex. Like, it's just not in the way they're made up. But they love them with their whole body and their whole soul. Mm-hmm. And it's not to say that that's what people have to do. They don't have to go get married. That's not what we want. But what the goal is to focus on the here and now, like what's going on now, and are you forming the relationship, healthy relationships now with same-sex and opposite-sex peers? Mm-hmm. Because if you're not, that's where we need to focus.
Yeah.
We don't need to worry about what it'll be like in 20 or 30 years. We can have a mind to it. There could be some prudence maybe, right? But we don't know what God has prepared for us. We're given, oftentimes people say, well, I don't know what my vocation is. When this comes up, they attach it to vocation. And I can just never see myself married to somebody of the opposite sex. I find that repugnant. Okay. We were given our first vocation in baptism, vocation to holiness, universal call to holiness. And I think that it is constituted of two parts. The first is learning to receive God's love as a beloved son or daughter. And then the second part is to share that love with those who we encounter who are suffering,
right,
who don't know the love of God or who doubt it or whatever. And we become spiritual parents when we do that. We give birth to God in them, if you will. And that second part, becoming spiritual parents, is not a consolation because we're not married and don't have biological children. It's constitutive to every single person's vocation. My parents have 10 children, they still have to be spiritual parents to those who they encounter in the world, or they're not fulfilling their universal call to holiness. And they know that. And they talk about, like if you look at mentorship, like why are these, business moguls taking on this person who doesn't make all this money and such, and yet they find so much joy in investing in them, their time and teaching them how to do things. Because it's one of the most joyful things is to give yourself freely to another person for their good. Mm. And so by focusing, in on living out those two aspects, first seeing themselves as beloved as son or daughter, and then sharing that with others, finding a way to concretely share that with others, whether that be in, big brother, big sister, or soup kitchen, or it could be working for the church. It could be all sorts of different ways, right? They're able to then find joy in the midst of the suffering of not having, let's say, a sexual partner at present, right? Or worried about marriage. But as they start to live that and immerse themselves in it, God reveals where he wants them to be. And this is true for any vocation, whether you have same-sex attraction or opposite-sex attraction, if you're young, if you're old, if you have any question about a vocation, right? Like If you're living those two aspects, God's mm-hmm. going to show you where he wants you to incarnate his love in the world, whether right. that be in a family or whether that be in the priesthood or in the religious life. Mm-hmm. And so by focusing on that, we can make great strides in the spiritual life, find joy in the midst of suffering, but also peace and contentment in this life. Peace insofar as we know we're going in the right direction, right?
A reasonable peace.
Yeah, a reasonable peace. But we can also, that also tends to build a support group around us, a family, if you will, right? Yeah. So that we can feel loved and cared for and lean on them if we need them.
Right.
And at that point, then the vocation of where we're going will figure itself out, because we have to have that integration of who I am as a man or a woman and what it means to love as a man, other men or women, that and vice versa for women, right? Like, so that we can take on that role of spiritual parent in the capacity that we've been given by God as men and women, which is, you know, a necessary accident to our substance. It's part of who we are, and we can't get rid of it.
Now, you've been associate director for 4 or 5 years, mm-hmm. and what have you seen? To me, it's interesting too to have meetings that are mixed. Do you have both kind? Do you separate men from women?
Yeah. So the normal way that Courage kind of approaches ministry to those who are struggling with same-sex attraction and who have chosen to live a chaste life is we'll get together once a week or so, and at the meeting we'll start with a prayer. We'll read the 5 goals. Then we'll check in, and then. We'll end with a prayer, and we'll have time for conversation and bonding around that. Oftentimes, the men and women typically want to kind of separate themselves out because there's just some big differences between sort of the male homosexual lifestyle and the female homosexual lifestyle, right? There's also oftentimes different wounds and experiences that led to that, or feelings about it. Oftentimes, there's different comorbidities because of the feminine genius and the masculine genius, to be honest. When they're taken to an extreme in some ways, you know, unrestrained male libido is a powerful opiate, you know, and that's very much often a part of, a male member's experience. Yeah. And, you know, sometimes multiple times a week, multiple times a day, having sex or using that to act out. And it's like, okay, well, that's something different that might have to be held accountable. And, you know, some women might find that very off-putting in a meeting.
Yeah,
and so
yeah.
often we'll separate them if we can.
Yeah.
The women make up about between 5 and 7, maybe 8% of the members, maybe 10.
Oh.
It's predominantly male.
Oh, okay.
And I think part of that is, again, going to the feminine genius, there's a realization of... when there's a realization of who they are and that they're a beloved daughter, I think they more naturally come into the spiritual motherhood, in which they can find fulfillment in this life as far as we can. And the managing of behavior is mostly a compulsive emotional bonding, which is, let's say, not...
For the woman?
For the woman. It's not as social... People aren't necessarily always aware, but it's internal, right? And so she's more able to sort that out with friends and a priest in a separate group, right?
Yeah.
And not necessarily have to have more of the accountability from the compulsive behavior and action side, where the men definitely tend to need that.
Yeah.
And so they're far more likely to be going to meetings, not just going to meetings, but going to meetings consistently so that they can overcome a particular behavior that they're struggling with.
Yeah, I asked that because I was wanted to ask too just about that interaction between the men and women and how healing that would be for them. Because as you mentioned, sometimes attraction comes out of a woundedness in these areas. But too, I remember one time I was staying up at the next to Mundelein, there's the shrine, Marytown.
Yeah.
And at the time, they were having a Encourage meeting at Mundelein, at the seminary in Chicago. And I remember somehow, I interacted with some of the meeting members, and it was kind of neat to see the women and the men together. I don't know, there was something about, there was this, you know, you could feel maybe like a sense of wounding struggle or something, or but at the same time, like an energy there that was, it seemed kind of healing about it. I don't know what it was.
So that was probably our annual conference. That's that we've had it there for quite a while, off and on. And we have Encourage members, Courage members who are men, Courage members who are women, and then we also have unique groups such as like Encourage spouses. So these are individuals who are married to someone who has same-sex attraction. Maybe they're dealing with it, maybe they're not. But they're in a marriage with them, and so we have support groups for that. So like we kind of take all the little bits and bobs of different groups, even if they're small, and we bring them all together at the annual conference. And there's a great camaraderie there, not just because, you know, they get to see each other in their little groups, but because they get to look around and go, we're not alone.
Right.
Even if, you know, a parent whose child is, you know, transitioning and kind of living that way, right, they still find solace and camaraderie and support in work, you know, being with parents whose children are in the same-sex lifestyle, or individuals who have experienced same-sex attraction but are able to speak to the pain that is going to be somewhat similar to what their child's going through, feeling unloved and insufficient and things like that. And they're really able to bond, and it's not a big depressing thing. It's actually a really exciting, happy thing at the annual conference, which is really kind of interesting because, I mean, there's a lot of suffering that individuals are going through, and parents and such. And rather than it becoming something dour, it becomes something joyful, which is really kind of interesting when you think about it. I mean, obviously with, you know, mass and all that kind of stuff each day and confessions and adoration, of course, but like just being together and sharing those things, you know, a burden shared is a burden halved.
And I would think too, just it gives people an opportunity. Suppose you have some kind of male wound or feminine wound or something, that you could be in these kind of settings and experience some healing, right? That you're maybe normally would not be together. You know, you wouldn't have these kind of friendships or deeper friendships with the opposite sex.
Yeah.
I would think that could be a healing thing.
Well, and in the same sex too. I mean, like, and it's not even in like, you know, as academic or intellectual, it's like, well, you know, I've seen where this lack is and how I view myself as a man or as a woman. And so I seek out this. No. Like they just enjoy each other's company and they find, you know, a joy of life in that. And they continue with that relationship, and the Lord heals when they're not looking, right? They're not necessarily digging through all these things, but rather just living life. A Christian life based around virtues and recognizing the good of the other person. And I think that does more than any sort of psychotherapy or anything. And I would never, I wouldn't recommend someone to do, you know, psychotherapy for change of orientation or gender stuff. It's like, no. Let's talk about fear and anxiety if you need to. That's fine, right? We just need to live a virtuous life and the Lord will sort everything else out. We all have questions and struggles, and that's okay. And that's a reality. We also have the ability to freely choose how we're going to act. And so we can help balance those things and seek those things if that's what you want, you know.
You know, I remember when I was in seminary, like in 02 or something, Father John Harvey came and spoke at the seminary. And the one point I remember him making that struck me was, you know, we speak of same-sex attracted persons, and he said we don't identify people as to their sexual orientation.
Yeah, right? And adulterers, thieves.
Yeah.
Paul can do it. We don't. Yeah. Actually, Paul doesn't even really do it. Paul speaks of the actions. Yeah, anyway.
Yeah, yeah, it's true. He does, yeah, it's an action thing. But Because that's what I always hear, like in some movements in the church, it's like they're kind of seem like they're just dying to reinforce this identity. And to me, it's like, well, if this is your identity, ultimately, why not act upon it, right?
Yeah.
If this is who I am. And I always, that's what I always hear. It's kind of like this litmus test for orthodoxy or something that I've heard in different stuff going on today. But so that's still maintained, encouraged.
I would say I would caution against just using that as a litmus test, because there's a couple of groups that have kind of grown up, ones at Steubenville, Integritas, and then Eden Invitation. And there's, I'll say it this way. I mean, obviously I'm a little biased because I work for Courage, but I'd say Courage is kind of the old person on the block. But then again, you know, we came from members who had removed themselves intentionally from a lifestyle and then sought to work on overcoming some of those things. And they had the guidance of a spiritual father. And so there's a little bit, there's a place, right, for a father to say, no, no, no. Just because you lied to me, you are not a liar. Mm-hmm. You made a mistake.
Yeah.
You're more than that, right? And there's a lot of really good sort of support outreach now, Catholic and Protestant, that's saying, you're more than this identity. Don't let it limit you. But a lot of them will still use the language and the words because it's common. And part of the reason why Courage has been, I don't want to say strict, but has been so aware and clear in that, or at least I try to be, Courage is, I try to be, is because we need to have a definition or a label, an identity of self, right, that can encompass the fact that we are beloved children of God, we are created for relationship, we are body-soul composite, we are made to live a life of virtue, we are made to be fulfilled in vocation, like, you know, all these different things have to be able to fit in that identity. Otherwise, it's not sufficient to define us. And it might be a good tool to move forward, you know, speaking with a young person who identified as asexual, it turns out that they, and non-binary, it turns out that the young lady was exposed to modern pornography, which is very sadomasochistic and unnatural things. And she said, well, if that's sex, then I will, nobody will ever do that.
Right.
And I will never be married and I will never have a family. It's like, okay, you're using the label to try and wrap your mind around something that never should have happened. I'm really sorry that happened. It's okay if you need to use that label to move and protect yourself. Just know that it'll probably change when you fall in love and get married and want to have kids.
Right.
And that's okay.
Right.
And the non-binary, well, uncomfortable with, you know, she was uncomfortable with her body. And in this case, she asked to speak with me and her parents were with her. And she said, well, you know, I don't really feel comfortable. Well, you know, you're going through puberty. It's okay.
Yeah.
You will eventually. And I think the last one was like biromantic. What does that mean to you, right? And a lot of this is unpacking what somebody means. What does that mean? When you say that, what does that mean for you? Well, you know, I want to have emotionally and psychologically intimate relationships with both men and women that are not sexual. Okay, well, we call that friendship, right? And that's something that we should be seeking for the whole of our life, whether we're married or single or whatever. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Now, they've got labels for everything because, and this is kind of natural for that sort of adolescent time period. I mean, if you think back to high school, they're jocks, they're teachers' pets, bookworms, right? It's the same thing. The difference is they've been told that sex is the most important, so all the labels revolve around that, rather than revolving around their relationship between like adults and kids and coolness and not, you know, like.
Or, that's a great point. Yeah, because the sexuality is constantly being shouted at them in the media. Yeah, the label is going to revolve around that.
Well, and here's the really funny thing. Statistically, do you know the people who have the most sex and are most satisfied with it?
Married people.
Heterosexual married couples.
Yeah.
The young people nowadays are having less than their grandparents ever did, and they're less satisfied with their sex lives. And you're like, well, no wonder, because they're looking at it going, well, I did all those things that they said, and I'm not happy.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the sad side of it is we're getting, you know, individuals and it's not like broken or tainted, like, you know. I mean, our Lord looks at it. I mean, he stands with us if we've been exposed to these things or if we've had these encounters. He says, I'm so sorry you've gone through this. I don't love you any less because of this. I can never love you any less because of this. I can not be okay with an action and ask you to repent, but I don't love you any less. I can't love you any less. I love you infinitely. And I'm in awe with you. Just turn to me, you know? And when that can be communicated, you know, I mean, any sin can be overcome.
Right.
But it can be really hard to see that if, you know, it's our relationship with same-sex and opposite-sex mentors as we're going through, like, later childhood and into adolescence that kind of form us and teach us what God's love is supposed to look like. Mm-hmm. And if there's wounds there, and we could define a wound, Bob Schutz defines it as, within a relationship where love should have been, love was not. Now, mm-hmm. that could be because somebody died. It could be because they were abusive or whatever it is. Or it could be that I perceived it wrong because I couldn't receive what they were giving in the way that I needed to receive it. Mm-hmm. All of the, like, that kind of a wound, I mean, that leaves lasting questions about my worth as a human being, but also about how much God loves me. Because how do I know what God's love is like? Most of us don't feel his arms around us or hear his voice in our ear audibly, like, that he loves us. And so we receive that from others. They are the incarnational, our parents, us in our vocation as priests, we are to be the incarnational realities of God's love in the world. And, you know, if somebody doesn't receive that love in that relationship with us, that causes a wound, even if it's a minor one, right?
Right. I feel like I was telling a priest this recently that I feel like the lay people, I think, are going to lead like the pastoral development, teaching, example, you know, because I get asked as a priest, you know, how do we navigate this?
Yeah.
But I really feel like it's going to be the hard learned lessons of these encourage parents.
Sure. Yeah. Well, and I mean, like, you know, a mother worried about her children is pretty fierce and loud and squeaky, whatever you need to be, right? I think you're right. Well, I mean, if you look at the history of the church, mm-hmm. From a very wide lens of, you know, 2,000 years, about every 500 years, there's, if you will, you know, there's a church of, let's say, institution or power that gets, it gains power, and then it gets a little too close to the secular power, and it loses authority. And as it's doing that, what rises up is holy people, a church of piety, if you will. Mm-hmm. And we can see that kind of happen again and again. Last time was roughly around the Protestant Revolution. So I think we're looking for another one here soon. And it's not a program, right? It's not a top-down thing. It's people who have said, I must get to heaven. I'm not going to make any excuses.
What are some, over the years now, what are some of the comments from members, maybe insights they've given you on friendship, healthy friendship, how to live it, what fosters it? Have you yourself heard some good stories or learned something from being in the group?
You never know where that friendship's going to come from, to be honest. You know, people say, well, you know, this is really what I need, or the type of person that I'm most connected to. And, you know, a member who drives 2 hours to go see another member who's really struggling and says, pack your stuff and come to my house. You're going to stay with me for a week till we get this straightened out.
Yeah.
And they're like, I barely even know you. Like, we're going to get this taken care of.
Yeah.
We both have a background, you know, like something like that. You're like, well, that's crazy. And then they become the best of friends, and they have like very different personalities and interests and everything, but they're bonded over this. Mm. Sometimes it's people that have very similar, you know, likes. It's always united around this desire to grow in virtue, though.
Yeah.
And I would say especially, at least for the men that I've talked to, I think of one member who, older in life, maybe in his 70s, started going to daily mass after he retired. And so for about the last 5-6 years or whatever, and just recently had knee surgery or whatever. And he would get coffee after mass with a group of guys, and they called him up, you know, we really missed you. When are you going to be able to join us? We hope you get better soon. Mm. Shattered his world because he belongs with a group of men now.
Yeah.
It took that long though. I mean, he's been encouraged for 30 years,
yeah.
You know? And so like, and that wasn't one friendship. That was a friendship with a group. Right.
Right.
He had good one-on-one friendships with people, and he still had some real struggles, but here he is, you know, it just kind of opens up the eyes. As far as a lot of it is being able to be, truly vulnerable with the other person, open and honest, like full honesty. And for our members, especially, right, as they're trying to grow in that holiness with each other, to be open and honest within their relationships with each other, to say, you know, I'm feeling this way, and I know that that's because of this habit, right? But I'm letting you know that so that you can hold me accountable, and so that, you know, we don't, you know, it doesn't, I don't let it keep going, so that I remove the secrecy from it and bring it to the light so that this is no longer something I have to be ashamed of.
Yeah, that's powerful. Yeah, to unite people. Yeah, if you can bring out stuff that you've been ashamed of your life, and then some other person can understand it. Man, yeah, that's strong.
And I would say that's one of the more powerful parts of meeting consistently. And that's why, like with courage, for the individuals who are struggling, we tend to meet once a week if we can. Mm. That's the ideal, to kind of build those things and work through them.
I remember interviewing a woman that she became Catholic, but in the Protestant church where she was at, the pastor would say, you know, people go where they're loved. Mm-hmm. And I've heard this from parents too, that they're trying to bring back a teenager maybe that's getting involved in the lifestyle. And it's like they found one in particular, I'm thinking of, it's on the internet, right? They found this niche spot that they were accepted and quote unquote experienced love, I guess. But and I think, you know, it's a powerful message for us trying to help others, right? Sure. Are we sure we're giving the love message, you know, and we have that kind of acceptance, and that's got to be at the heart, right, of living, helping people live chaste lives.
Well, and I think that's something that we can preach on regularly too, is like what love really looks like, right? Love is not about me feeling good. Mm-hmm. Never has been, right? Sometimes I might get it, but I mentioned my parents have 10 kids. There are plenty of times they got up and they're like, ugh, right? Yeah. You know, how many married couples wake up and look over at that person next to them and go, damn it. Or maybe not that far hard, but then they go about their day loving them and serving and pouring themselves out for them. That's love, right?
Yeah.
Not well, you know, there's nothing you could ever do that's wrong, right? You know, we might smack a child's hand when they try to touch the burner on a stove because it's going to harm them. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean we love them less, right? Mm-hmm. We can't, like, you know, for the parent who loves their child, they can't and they won't love them less because mm-hmm. they do one thing wrong or 10 things wrong or 1,000 things wrong. They can be disappointed in an action or in a choice. They don't love them less.
Right.
And so God doesn't love us less either. And there's that perception, there's that lie that, well, if you reject any part of me, you reject me completely because I am my feelings. It's kind of that modern sort of twist on the moralistic therapeutic deism of the modern sort of post-Christian culture where... you know, I am my feelings. And so if my feelings cannot be heard, then you are rejecting me. And, you know, how many years ago it was like, really doesn't matter what my feelings are. I just need to go take care of work, right? And that's actually a sign of affective immaturity, right? Of a lack of emotional intelligence. That's the intelligence. Those are the buzzwords in business. Mm-hmm. Like the emotional intelligence in some really is okay, I'm feeling this emotion, happiness, sadness, anger, whatever, and I'm going to hold it to the side. Mm-hmm. I recognize that you're feeling something and you have some desires and thoughts that you want to bring out, and I'm going to be able to attend to that. I'm actually going to help you actualize that while not bringing my feelings to bear on it.
Right.
Yeah, that's emotional intelligence. It's really not. I mean, the only way that it's taught, though, is that you give someone responsibility and they fail and you critique them in a constructive way, and then you have them go and do it again and again and again. And there's been a lot of hamstringing of, you know, not letting adolescents learn those things. And then how can they get a summer job with, you know, and all these other things where they struggle to get a summer job and they're not given responsibilities. And, you know, at what point does mom let them ride their bike around the neighborhood?
Yeah.
And you know, it's like all these kind of things build up, and then being online as well, right? Like if I'm not getting likes, I'm not feeling good. Mm-hmm. It's like, well, that's not love. In fact, that's really just a dopamine response to a training scenario. Like it's not actually going to make you happy. Yeah. And so when we confuse pleasure and happiness with each other, happiness being that feeling of joy or rest. There's a Catholic psychologist, Conrad Bars. He's since passed away. His daughter has continued his legacy. But he speaks of affirmation versus approval. Affirmation is that feeling that you have when you're loved for who you are. Not, you did a good job on this test, and so I love you, right? That in some way that's approval, right? Mm-hmm. Or if you do this, then I approve of you, right? But rather, it doesn't matter what you do.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter whether you succeed or fail. I love you either way.
Right.
I'm proud. You might say something like, I'm proud that you're taking this seriously as they're studying for the test, right? If we want to keep down on that example. And what most of these people are seeking is actually affirmation, because affirmation doesn't require you to do anything or provide me with anything or to change anything. I just love you for who you are.
Yeah.
And that's how God loves us. He doesn't make mistakes.
Right.
And we don't have to change things. And we can have questions and concerns and doubts and all these worries. But in the end, we are loved. And I think that's the aspect I think that culture is going to have to pick up to go full circle back to where we began with these individuals, these parents, right, that have struggled with this. They're the ones that are going to, like, they've gone full circle and they're loving in that way. And maybe their kid isn't in their life anymore, right? Because, you know, they've rejected them or whatever, or they feel rejected rather. But they start to love the people in their community that way because that's how they're living.
Mm.
And if you love people in your community unconditionally, that affects them, and that in turn affects them who they love, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, I think that's how, you know, if I had to really kind of go full circle with it, I think that's how it's going to happen. Is like the individuals encourage, they learn it, they learn how to do that unconditional mm-hmm. love, and they have their struggles of compulsion. The parents in encourage don't necessarily have struggles with compulsions per se, right? They might themselves, but in general, they're just mm-hmm. trying to come and understand how to maintain that relationship. We give them a blueprint, right, to live a virtuous life, and we encourage them in that and hold them accountable and help them to grow in holiness. And as they grow in holiness, they love those in their community, especially those who struggle with this because they have children that do.
Mm-hmm.
Not in the sense of like, oh, we'll have a cookout and invite everybody with same-sex attraction, right?
Mm-hmm.
But in the sense of, you know, if they know, like, they somebody at the parish, right, they just love who they are. They don't care what their orientation is. It doesn't
right.
matter. And so whether that person has a same sex or opposite sex orientation, right, like, or struggle, right, they're able to just be loved by them.
Yeah.
Which then affects how that person interacts within the parish. And so when our members are in a parish and there's, you know, people say, well, you know, how do we help them? How do we let them be in the parish? They need a parish to support them. Yes, the church's teachings are still there and we don't compromise those, but like they need to be at the parish picnic just as much as everyone else.
Yeah.
You know, and they don't need to be different than anybody else.
Right. All right. Well, hey, the sister's calling you back. I pulled you out of a retreat you're giving here. So this is the sister servants at Casa Maria. And but thank you, Father Blatchford, for talking with us today.
Absolutely. It's a pleasure. Thank you, Father.